Chapter 26 Continued. Left alone in the dark room, Harry turned towards the wall. A cracked, age-spotted mirror hung on the wall in the shadows. Harry moved towards it. His reflection grew larger and clearer in the darkness. A face whiter than a skull, red eyes with slits for pupils.
"No!"
"What?" yelled a voice nearby. Harry flailed around madly, became entangled in the hangings, and fell out of his bed. For a few seconds, he did not know where he was. He was convinced he was about to see the white, skull-like face looming at him out of the dark again. Then, very near to him, Ron's voice spoke.
"Will you stop acting like a maniac so I can get you out of here?"
Ron wrenched the hangings apart, and Harry stared up at him in the moonlight, flat on his back, his scar searing with pain. Ron looked as though he'd just been getting ready for bed. One arm was out of his robes.
"Has someone been attacked again?" asked Ron, pulling Harry roughly to his feet. "Is it Dad? Is it that snake?"
"No, everyone's fine," gasped Harry, whose forehead felt as though it were on fire.
"Well, Avery isn't. He's in trouble. He gave him the wrong information. Voldemort's really angry."
Harry groaned and sank, shaking onto his bed, rubbing his scar.
"But Rookwood's going to help him now. He's on the right track again."
"What are you talking about?" said Ron, sounding scared.
"Do you mean, did you just see you-know-who?"
"I was you-know-who," said Harry,
and he stretched out his hands in the darkness and held them up to his face to check that they were no longer deathly white and long-fingered.
"He was with Rookwood. He's one of the Death Eaters who escaped from Azkaban, remember? Rookwood's just told him Bode couldn't have done it."
"Done what?"
"Removed something. He said Bode would have known he couldn't have done it. Bode was under the Imperius curse. I think he said Malfoy's dad put it on him."
"Bode was bewitched to remove something," Ron said.
"But, Harry, that's got to be
the weapon." Harry finished the sentence for him.
"I know."
The dormitory door opened. Dean and Seamus came in. Harry swung his legs back into bed. He did not want to look as though anything odd had just happened, seeing as Seamus had only just stopped thinking Harry was a nutter.
"Did you say,"
murmured Ron, putting his head close to Harry's, on the pretense of helping himself to water from the jug on his bedside table,
"that you were you know who?"
"Yeah," said Harry quietly. Ron took an unnecessarily large gulp of water. Harry saw it spill over his chin onto his chest.
"Harry," he said,
as Dean and Seamus clattered around noisily, pulling off their robes and talking,
"you've got to tell..."
"I haven't got to tell anyone," said Harry shortly.
"I wouldn't have seen it at all if I could do occlumency. I'm supposed to have learnt to shut this stuff out. That's what they want."
By they, he meant Dumbledore. He got back into bed and rolled over onto his side, with his back to Ron, and after a while he heard Ron's mattress creak as he, too, lay back down. Harry's scar began to burn. He bit hard on his pillow to stop himself making a noise. Somewhere, he knew, Avery was being punished. Harry and Ron waited until break next morning to tell Hermione exactly what had happened. They wanted to be absolutely sure they could not be overheard. Standing in their usual corner of the cool and breezy courtyard, Harry told her every detail of the dream he could remember. When he had finished, she said nothing at all for a few moments, but stared with a kind of painful intensity at Fred and George, who were both headless and selling their magical hats from under their cloaks on the other side of the yard.
"So that's why they killed him," she said quietly,
withdrawing her gaze from Fred and George at last.
"When Bode tried to steal this weapon, something funny happened to him. I think there must be defensive spells on it or around it to stop people touching it. That's why he was in St. Mungo's. His brain had gone all funny and he couldn't talk. But remember what the healer told us? He was recovering, and they couldn't risk him getting better, could they? I mean, the shock of whatever happened when he touched that weapon probably made the imperious curse lift. Once he'd got his voice back, he'd explain what he'd been doing, wouldn't he? They would have known he'd been sent to steal the weapon. Of course, it would have been easy for Lucius Malfoy to put the curse on him. Never out of the ministry, is he? He was even hanging around that day I had my hearing, said Harry, in the... Hang on, he said slowly. He was in the Department of Mysteries corridor that day. Your dad said he was probably trying to sneak down and find out what happened in my hearing. But what if... Sturgis! Gasped Hermione, looking thunderstruck.
Sorry? Said Ron, looking bewildered.
Sturgis Podmore, said Hermione breathlessly, arrested for trying to get through a door. Lucius Malfoy must have got him, too. I bet he did it the day you saw him there, Harry. Sturgis had Moody's invisibility cloak, right? So what if he was standing guard by the door, invisible, and Malfoy heard him move, or guessed someone was there, or just did the imperious curse on the off chance there'd be a guard there? So, when Sturgis next had an opportunity, probably when it was his turn on guard duty again, he tried to get into the department to steal the weapon for Voldemort. Ron, be quiet. But he got caught and sent to Azkaban. She gazed at Harry. And now Rookwood's told Voldemort how to get the weapon.
I didn't hear all the conversation, but that's what it sounded like, said Harry.
Rookwood used to work there. Maybe Voldemort'll send Rookwood to do it.
Hermione nodded, apparently still lost in thought.
Then quite abruptly, she said, But you shouldn't have seen this at all, Harry.
What? He said, taken aback.
You're supposed to be learning how to close your mind to this sort of thing, said Hermione, suddenly stern.
I know I am, said Harry, but,
well, I think we should just try and forget what you saw, said Hermione firmly, and you ought to put in a bit more effort on your occlumency from now on.
The week did not improve as it progressed. Harry received 2 more D's in potions. He was still on tenterhooks that Hagrid might get the sack, and he couldn't stop himself dwelling on the dream in which he had been Voldemort, though he didn't bring it up with Ron and Hermione again. He didn't want another telling off from Hermione. He wished very much that he could have talked to Sirius about it, but that was out of the question, so he tried to push the matter to the back of his mind. Unfortunately, the back of his mind was no longer the secure place it had once been.
Get up, Potter!
A couple of weeks after his dream of Rookwood, Harry was to be found, yet again, kneeling on the floor of Snape's office, trying to clear his head. He had just been forced, yet again, to relive a stream of very early memories he had not even realized he still had, most of them concerning humiliations Dudley and his gang had inflicted upon him in primary school.
"That last memory," said Snape. "What was it?"
"I don't know," said Harry, getting wearily to his feet.
He was finding it increasingly difficult to disentangle separate memories from the rush of images and sound that Snape kept calling forth.
"You mean the one where my cousin tried to make me stand in the toilet?"
"No," said Snape softly.
"I mean the one with a man kneeling in the middle of a darkened room."
"It's nothing," said Harry.
Snape's dark eyes bored into Harry's. Remembering what Snape had said about eye contact being crucial to legilimency, Harry blinked and looked away.
"How did that man and that room come to be inside your head, Potter?" said Snape.
"It," said Harry, looking everywhere but at Snape, "it was just a dream I had."
"A dream?" repeated Snape.
There was a pause, during which Harry stared fixedly at a large dead frog suspended in a jar of purple liquid.
"You do know why we are here, don't you, Potter?" said Snape, in a low, dangerous voice. "You do know why I am giving up my evenings to this tedious job?"
"Yes," said Harry stiffly.
"Remind me why we are here," Potter.
So I can learn occlumency, said Harry, now glaring at a dead eel.
Correct, Potter. And dim though you may be, Harry looked back at Snape, hating him, I would have thought that after over 2 months of lessons you might have made some progress. How many other dreams about the Dark Lord have you had?
Just that one, lied Harry.
Perhaps, said Snape, his dark, cold eyes narrowing slightly, perhaps you actually enjoy having these visions and dreams, Potter. Maybe they make you feel special, important.
No, they don't, said Harry, his jaw set and his fingers clenched tightly around the handle of his wand.
That is just as well, Potter, said Snape coldly, because you are neither special nor important, and it is not up to you to find out what the Dark Lord is saying to his Death Eaters.
No, that's your job, isn't it? Harry shot at him.
He had not meant to say it. It had burst out of him in temper. For a long moment they stared at each other, Harry convinced he had gone too far. But there was a curious, almost satisfied expression on Snape's face when he answered.
"Yes, Potter," he said, his eyes glinting. "That is my job. Now, if you are ready, we will start again."
He raised his wand.
"One, two, three. Legilimens!"
100 Dementors were swooping towards Harry across the lake in the grounds. He screwed up his face in concentration. They were coming closer. He could see the dark holes beneath their hoods. Yet he could also see Snape standing in front of him, his eyes fixed on Harry's face, muttering under his breath. And somehow Snape was growing clearer and the Dementors were growing fainter. Harry raised his own wand.
"Protego!"
Snape staggered. His wand flew upwards, away from Harry, and suddenly Harry's mind was teeming with memories that were not his. A hook-nosed man was shouting at a cowering woman, while a small dark-haired boy cried in a corner. A greasy-haired teenager sat alone in a dark bedroom, pointing his wand at the ceiling, shooting down flies. A girl was laughing as a scrawny boy tried to mount a bucking broomstick.
"Enough!"
Harry felt as though he had been pushed hard in the chest. He staggered several steps backwards, hit some of the shelves covering Snape's walls, and heard something crack. Snape was shaking slightly, and was very white in the face. The back of Harry's robes was damp. One of the jars behind him had broken when he fell against it. The pickled, slimy thing within was swirling in its draining potion.
"Ripero!"
hissed Snape, and the jar sealed itself at once.
"Well, Potter, that was certainly an improvement."
Panting slightly, Snape straightened the pensive in which he had again stored some of his thoughts before starting the lesson, almost as though he was checking they were still there.
"I don't remember telling you to use a shield charm. There is no doubt that it was effective."
Harry did not speak. He felt that to say anything might be dangerous. He was sure he had just broken into Snape's memories, that he had just seen scenes from Snape's childhood. It was unnerving to think that the little boy who had been crying as he watched his parents shouting was actually standing in front of him with such loathing in his eyes.
"Let's try again, shall we?" said Snape.
Harry felt a thrill of dread. He was about to pay for what had just happened. He was sure of it. They moved back into position with the desk between them, Harry feeling he was going to find it much harder to empty his mind this time.
"On the count of three, then," said Snape,
raising his wand once more.
"One, two."
Harry did not have time to gather himself together and attempt to clear his mind before Snape cried,
"Legilimens!"
He was hurtling along the corridor towards the Department of Mysteries, past the blank stone walls, past the torches. The plain black door was growing ever larger. He was moving so fast, he was going to collide with it. He was feet from it, and again he could see that chink of faint blue light. The door had flown open.
He was through it at last, inside a black-walled, black-floored circular room lit with blue-flamed candles. And there were more doors all around him. He needed to go on. But which door ought he to take?
Potter!
Harry opened his eyes. He was flat on his back again, with no memory of having got there. He was also panting as though he really had run the length of the Department of Mysteries corridor, really had sprinted through the black door and found the circular room.
"Explain yourself,"
said Snape, who was standing over him, looking furious.
"I don't know what happened," said Harry truthfully, standing up.
There was a lump on the back of his head from where he had hit the ground, and he felt feverish.
"I've never seen that before. I mean, I told you, I've dreamed about the door, but it's never opened before."
"You are not working hard enough!"
For some reason, Snape seemed even angrier than he had done 2 minutes before, when Harry had seen into his teacher's memories.
"You are lazy and sloppy, Potter. It is small wonder that the Dark Lord—"
"Can you tell me something, sir?" said Harry, firing up again. "Why do you call Voldemort the Dark Lord? I've only ever heard Death Eaters call him that."
Snape opened his mouth in a snarl, and a woman screamed from somewhere outside the room. Snape's head jerked upwards. He was gazing at the ceiling.
"What the—"
he muttered. Harry could hear a muffled commotion coming from what he thought might be the entrance hall. Snape looked round at him, frowning.
"Did you see anything unusual on your way down here, Potter?"
Harry shook his head. Somewhere above them, the woman screamed again. Snape strode to his office door, his wand still held at the ready, and swept out of sight. Harry hesitated for a moment, then followed. The screams were indeed coming from the entrance hall. They grew louder as Harry ran towards the stone steps leading up from the dungeons. When he reached the top, he found the entrance hall packed. Students had come flooding out of the great hall, where dinner was still in progress, to see what was going on. Others had crammed themselves onto the marble staircase. Harry pushed forwards through a knot of tall Slytherins, and saw that the onlookers had formed a great ring, some of them looking shocked, others even frightened. Professor McGonagall was directly opposite Harry on the other side of the hall. She looked as though what she was watching made her feel faintly sick. Professor Trelawney was standing in the middle of the entrance hall with her wand in one hand and an empty sherry bottle in the other, looking utterly mad. Her hair was sticking up on end, her glasses were lopsided so that one eye was magnified more than the other, her innumerable shawls and scarves were trailing haphazardly from her shoulders, giving the impression that she was falling apart at the seams. Two large trunks lay on the floor beside her, one of them upside down. It looked very much as though it had been thrown down the stairs after her. Professor Trelawney was staring, apparently terrified, at something Harry could not see, but which seemed to be standing at the foot of the stairs.
"No!" she shrieked. "No! This cannot be happening! It cannot! I refuse to accept it!"
"You didn't realise this was coming?"
said a high, girlish voice, sounding callously amused. And Harry, moving slightly to his right, saw that Trelawney's terrifying vision was nothing other than Professor Umbridge.
"Incapable though you are of predicting even tomorrow's weather, you must surely have realised that your pitiful performance during my inspections and lack of any improvement would make it inevitable that you would be sacked."
"You can't!"
howled Professor Trelawney, tears streaming down her face from behind her enormous lenses.
"You can't sack me! I've been here 16 years. Hogwarts is my home!"
"It was your home,"
said Professor Umbridge, and Harry was revolted to see the enjoyment stretching her toad-like face as she watched Professor Trelawney sink, sobbing uncontrollably, onto one of her trunks.
"Until an hour ago, when the Minister for Magic countersigned your order of dismissal. Now kindly remove yourself from this hall. You are embarrassing us."
But she stood and watched with an expression of gloating enjoyment as Professor Trelawney shuddered and moaned, rocking backwards and forwards on her trunk in paroxysms of grief. Harry heard a muffled sob to his left and looked around. Lavender and Parvati were both crying quietly, their arms round each other. Then he heard footsteps. Professor McGonagall had broken away from the spectators, marched straight up to Professor Trelawney, and was patting her firmly on the back while withdrawing a large handkerchief from within her robes.
"There, there, Sybil, calm down. Blow your nose on this. It's not as bad as you think now. You're not going to have to leave Hogwarts."
"Oh, really, Professor McGonagall?" said Umbridge in a deadly voice, taking a few steps forward. "And your authority for that statement is?"
"That would be mine," said a deep voice. The oaken front doors had swung open. Students beside them scuttled out of the way as Dumbledore appeared in the entrance. What he had been doing out in the grounds Harry could not imagine, but there was something impressive about the sight of him framed in the doorway against an oddly misty night. Leaving the doors wide open behind him, he strode forwards through the circle of onlookers towards Professor Trelawney, tear-stained and trembling, on her trunk, Professor McGonagall alongside her.
"Yours, Professor Dumbledore?" said Umbridge, with a singularly unpleasant little laugh. "I'm afraid you do not understand the position. I have here," she pulled a parchment scroll from within her robes, "an order of dismissal, signed by myself and the Minister for Magic. Under the terms of Educational Decree No. 23, the High Inquisitor of Hogwarts has the power to inspect, place upon probation, and sack any teacher she, that is to say I, feel is not performing to the standards required by the Ministry of Magic. I have decided that Professor Trelawney is not up to scratch. I have dismissed her."
To Harry's very great surprise, Dumbledore continued to smile. He looked down at Professor Trelawney, who was still sobbing and choking on her trunk, and said, "You are quite right, of course, Professor Umbridge. As High Inquisitor, you have every right to dismiss my teachers. You do not, however, have the authority to send them away from the castle. I am afraid," he went on with a courteous little bow, "that the power to do that still resides with the headmaster, and it is my wish that Professor Trelawney continue to live at Hogwarts." At this, Professor Trelawney gave a wild little laugh in which a hiccup was barely hidden.
"No, no, I'll go, Dumbledore. I shall leave Hogwarts and seek my fortune elsewhere."
"No," said Dumbledore sharply. "It is my wish that you remain, Sybil." He turned to Professor McGonagall. "Might I ask you to escort Sybil back upstairs, Professor McGonagall?"
"Of course," said McGonagall. "Up you get, Sybil."
Professor Sprout came hurrying forwards out of the crowd and grabbed Professor Trelawney's other arm. Together they guided her past Umbridge and up the marble stairs. Professor Flitwick went scurrying after them, his wand held out before him. He squeaked, "Locomotor trunks!" And Professor Trelawney's luggage rose into the air and proceeded up the staircase after her, Professor Flitwick bringing up the rear. Professor Umbridge was standing stock still, staring at Dumbledore, who continued to smile benignly.
"And what," she said in a whisper that carried all around the entrance hall, "are you going to do with her once I appoint a new divination teacher who needs her lodgings?"
"Oh, that won't be a problem," said Dumbledore pleasantly. "You see, I have already found us a new divination teacher, and he will prefer lodgings on the ground floor."
"You've found?" said Umbridge shrilly.
"You've found, might I remind you, Dumbledore, that under Educational Decree No. 22...
"The Ministry has the right to appoint a suitable candidate if, and only if, the headmaster is unable to find one," said Dumbledore. "And I am happy to say that on this occasion I have succeeded. May I introduce you?"
He turned to face the open front doors, through which night mist was now drifting. Harry heard hooves. There was a shocked murmur around the hall, and those nearest the doors hastily moved even further backwards, some of them tripping over in their haste to clear a path for the newcomer. Through the mist came a face Harry had seen once before on a dark, dangerous night in the Forbidden Forest. White blonde hair and astonishingly blue eyes, the head and torso of a man, joined to the palomino body of a horse.
"This is Firenze," said Dumbledore happily to a thunderstruck Umbridge. "I think you'll find him suitable."
Chapter 27 The Centaur and the Sneak.
"I'll bet you wish you hadn't given up divination now, don't you, Hermione?"
asked Parvati, smirking. It was breakfast time, 2 days after the sacking of Professor Trelawney, and Parvati was curling her eyelashes around her wand and examining the effect in the back of her spoon. They were to have their first lesson with Firenze that morning.
"Not really," said Hermione, indifferently, who was reading the Daily Prophet. "I've never really liked horses."
She turned a page of the newspaper and scanned its columns.
"He's not a horse. He's a centaur," said Lavender, sounding shocked.
"A gorgeous centaur," sighed Parvati.
"Either way, he's still got 4 legs," said Hermione coolly. "Anyway, I thought you two were all upset that Trelawney had gone."
"We are," Lavender assured her.
"We went up to her office to see her. We took her some daffodils, not the honking ones that Sprout's got, nice ones."
"How is she?" asked Harry.
"Not very good, poor thing," said Lavender sympathetically. "She was crying and saying she'd rather leave the castle for ever than stay here where Umbridge is, and I don't blame her. Umbridge was horrible to her, wasn't she?"
"I've got a feeling Umbridge has only just started being horrible," said Hermione darkly.
"Impossible," said Ron, who was tucking into a large plate of eggs and bacon. "She can't get any worse than she's been already."
"You mark my words, she's going to want revenge on Dumbledore for appointing a new teacher without consulting her," said Hermione, closing the newspaper. "Especially another part human. You saw the look on her face when she saw Firenze."
After breakfast, Hermione departed for her arithmancy class as Harry and Ron followed Parvati and Lavender into the entrance hall, heading for divination.
"Aren't we going up to North Tower?"
asked Ron, looking puzzled, as Parvati bypassed the marble staircase. Parvati looked at him scornfully over her shoulder.
"How do you expect Firenze to climb that ladder? We're in Classroom 11 now. It was on the notice board yesterday."
Classroom 11 was on the ground floor along the corridor leading off the entrance hall from the opposite side to the great hall. Harry knew it was one of those classrooms that were never used regularly, and therefore had the slightly neglected feeling of a cupboard or storeroom. When he entered it right behind Ron and found himself in the middle of a forest clearing, he was therefore momentarily stunned.
"What the—"
The classroom floor had become springily mossy, and trees were growing out of it. Their leafy branches fanned across the ceiling and windows, so that the room was full of slanting shafts of soft, dappled green light. The students who had already arrived were sitting on the earthy floor with their backs resting against tree trunks or boulders, arms wrapped around their knees or folded tightly across their chests, and all looking rather nervous. In the middle of the clearing, where there were no trees, stood Firenze.
"Harry Potter," he said, holding out a hand when Harry entered.
"Hi," said Harry, shaking hands with the centaur, who surveyed him unblinkingly through those astonishingly blue eyes, but did not smile.
"Good to see you."
"And you," said the centaur, inclining his white blonde head. "It was foretold that we would meet again." Harry noticed there was the shadow of a hoof-shaped bruise on Firenze's chest. As he turned to join the rest of the class on the ground, he saw they were all looking at him in awe, apparently deeply impressed that he was on speaking terms with Firenze, whom they seemed to find intimidating. When the door was closed and the last student had sat down on a tree stump beside the waste paper basket, Firenze gestured around the room.
"Professor Dumbledore has kindly arranged this classroom for us," said Firenze, when everyone had settled down, "in imitation of my natural habitat. I would have preferred to teach you in the Forbidden Forest, which was, until Monday, my home. But that is no longer possible."
"Please, sir," said Parvati breathlessly, raising her hand. "Why not? We've been in there with Hagrid. We're not frightened."
"It is not a question of your bravery," said Firenze, "but of my position. I cannot return to the forest. My herd has banished me."
"Herd?" said Lavender in a confused voice, and Harry knew she was thinking of cows. "What? Oh!"
Comprehension dawned on her face.
"There are more of you?" she said, stunned.
"Did Hagrid breed you, like the Thestrals?" asked Dean eagerly.
Firenze turned his head very slowly to face Dean, who seemed to realize at once that he had said something very offensive.
I meant, sorry, he finished in a hushed voice.
"Centaurs are not the servants or playthings of humans," said Firenze quietly. There was a pause, then Parvati raised her hand again.
"Please, sir, why have the other centaurs banished you?"
"Because I have agreed to work for Professor Dumbledore," said Firenze. "They see this as a betrayal of our kind."
Harry remembered how, nearly 4 years ago, the centaur Bane had shouted at Firenze for allowing Harry to ride to safety on his back. He had called him a common mule. He wondered whether it had been Bane who had kicked Firenze in the chest.
"Let us begin," said Firenze.
He swished his long palomino tail, raised his hand towards the leafy canopy overhead, then lowered it slowly. And as he did so, the light in the room dimmed, so that they now seemed to be sitting in a forest clearing by twilight, and stars appeared on the ceiling. There were oohs and gasps, and Ron said audibly, "Blimey!"
"Lie back on the floor," said Firenze in his calm voice, "and observe the heavens. Here is written, for those who can see, the fortune of our races." Harry stretched out on his back and gazed upwards at the ceiling. A twinkling red star winked at him from overhead. "I know that you have learned the names of the planets and their moons in astronomy," said Firenze's calm voice, "and that you have mapped the stars' progress through the heavens. Centaurs have unravelled the mysteries of these movements over centuries. Our findings teach us that the future may be glimpsed in the sky above us."
"Professor Trelawney did astrology with us," said Parvati excitedly, raising her hand in front of her so that it stuck up in the air as she lay on her back. "Mars causes accidents and burns and things like that, and when it makes an angle to Saturn, like now," she drew a right angle in the air above her, "that means people need to be extra careful when handling hot things."
"That," said Firenze calmly, "is human nonsense." Parvati's hand fell limply to her side.
"Trivial hurts, tiny human accidents," said Firenze as his hooves thudded over the mossy floor. "These are of no more significance than the scurryings of ants to the wide universe, and are unaffected by planetary movements."
"Professor Trelawney,"
began Parvati in a hurt and indignant voice, "is a human,"
said Ferenczi simply, "and is therefore blinkered and fettered by the limitations of your kind." Harry turned his head very slightly to look at Parvati. She looked very offended, as did several of the people surrounding her. "Sybil Trelawney may have seen, I do not know," continued Ferenczi, and Harry heard the swishing of his tail again as he walked up and down before them. "But she wastes her time, in the main, on the self-flattering nonsense humans call fortune-telling. I, however, am here to explain the wisdom of centaurs, which is impersonal and impartial. We watch the skies for the great tides of evil, or change that are sometimes marked there. It may take 10 years to be sure of what we are seeing." Ferenczi pointed to the red star directly above Harry. "In the past decade, the indications have been that wizardkind is living through nothing more than a brief calm between two wars. Mars, bringer of battle, shines brightly above us, suggesting that the fight must soon break out again. How soon, centaurs may attempt to divine by the burning of certain herbs and leaves, by the observation of fume and flame." It was the most unusual lesson Harry had ever attended. They did indeed burn sage and mallowsweet there on the classroom floor, and Ferenczi told them to look for certain shapes and symbols in the pungent fumes. But he seemed perfectly unconcerned that not one of them could see any of the signs he described, telling them that humans were hardly ever good at this, that it took centaurs years and years to become competent, and finished by telling them that it was foolish to put too much faith in such things anyway, because even centaurs sometimes read them wrongly. He was nothing like any human teacher Harry had ever had. His priority did not seem to be to teach them what he knew, but rather to impress upon them that nothing, not even centaur's knowledge, was foolproof. "He's not very definite on anything, is he?" said Ron, in a low voice, as they put out their mallow-sweet fire. "I mean, I could do with a few more details about this war we're about to have, couldn't you?" The bell rang right outside the classroom door, and everyone jumped. Harry had completely forgotten they were still inside the castle, and quite convinced that he was really in the forest. The class filed out, looking slightly perplexed. Harry and Ron were on the point of following them when Ferenczi called. "Harry Potter, a word, please." Harry turned. The centaur advanced a little towards him. Ron hesitated. "You may stay," Ferenczi told him, "but close the door, please." Ron hastened to obey. "Harry Potter, you are a friend of Hagrid's, are you not?" said the centaur. "Yes," said Harry. "Then give him a warning from me. His attempt is not working. He would do better to abandon it." "His attempt is not working?" Harry repeated blankly. "And he would do better to abandon it," said Ferenczi, nodding. "I would warn Hagrid myself, but I am banished. It would be unwise for me to go too near the forest now. Hagrid has troubles enough without a centaur's battle." "But what's Hagrid attempting to do?" said Harry nervously. Ferenczi looked at Harry impassively. "Hagrid has recently rendered me a great service," said Ferenczi. "And he has long since earned my respect for the care he shows all living creatures. I shall not betray his secret, but he must be brought to his senses. The attempt is not working. Tell him, Harry Potter. Good day to you." The happiness Harry had felt in the aftermath of the Quibbler interview had long since evaporated. As a dull March blurred into a squally April, his life seemed to have become one long series of worries and problems again. Umbridge had continued attending all Care of Magical Creatures lessons, so it had been very difficult to deliver Ferenczi's warning to Hagrid. At last, Harry had managed it by pretending he had lost his copy of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, and doubling back after class one day. When he'd passed on Firenze's message, Hagrid gazed at him for a moment through his puffy, blackened eyes, apparently taken aback. Then he seemed to pull himself together.
"Nice bloke, Firenze," he said gruffly, "but he don't know what he's talking about on this. The attempt's coming on fine."
"Hagrid, what are you up to?" asked Harry seriously. "Because you've got to be careful. Umbridge has already sacked Trelawney, and if you ask me, she's on a roll. If you're doing anything you shouldn't be, you'll be..."
"There's more important things than keeping a job," said Hagrid,
though his hands shook slightly as he said this, and a basin full of canal droppings crashed to the floor.
"Don't worry about me, Harry. Just get along now. There's a good lad."
Harry had no choice but to leave Hagrid mopping up the dung all over his floor, but he felt thoroughly dispirited as he trudged back up to the castle. Meanwhile, as the teachers and Hermione persisted in reminding them, the OWLs were drawing ever nearer. All the fifth years were suffering from stress to some degree, but Hannah Abbott became the first to receive a calming draught from Madame Pumphrey after she burst into tears during Herbology and sobbed that she was too stupid to take exams and wanted to leave school now. If it had not been for the DA lessons, Harry thought he would have been extremely unhappy. He sometimes felt he was living for the hours he spent in the Room of Requirement, working hard but thoroughly enjoying himself at the same time, swelling with pride as he looked around at his fellow DA members and saw how far they had come. Indeed, Harry sometimes wondered how Umbridge was going to react when all the members of the DA received outstanding in their defence against the Dark Arts OWLs. They had finally started work on Patronuses, which everybody had been very keen to practice, though, as Harry kept reminding them, producing a Patronus in the middle of a brightly lit classroom when they were not under threat was very different from producing it when confronted by something like a Dementor. "Oh, don't be such a killjoy," said Cho brightly, watching her silvery, swan-shaped Patronus soar around the Room of Requirement during their last lesson before Easter. "They're so pretty." "They're not supposed to be pretty. They're supposed to protect you," said Harry patiently. "What we really need is a boggart or something. That's how I learned. I had to conjure a Patronus while a boggart was pretending to be a Dementor."
"But that would be really scary,"
said Lavender, who was shooting puffs of silver vapour out of the end of her wand.
"And I still can't do it," she added angrily.
Neville was having trouble too. His face was screwed up in concentration, but only feeble wisps of silver smoke issued from his wand tip. "You've got to think of something happy," Harry reminded him.
"I'm trying,"
said Neville miserably, who was trying so hard his round face was actually shining with sweat.
"Harry, I think I'm doing it,"
yelled Seamus, who had been brought along to his first ever DA meeting by Dean.
"Look, it's gone, but it was definitely something hairy, Harry."
Hermione's Patronus, a shining silver otter, was gambolling around her.
"They are sort of nice, aren't they?"
she said, looking at it fondly. The door of the Room of Requirement opened and closed. Harry looked round to see who had entered, but there did not seem to be anybody there. It was a few moments before he realised that the people close to the door had fallen silent. Next thing he knew, something was tugging at his robe somewhere near the knee. He looked down and saw, to his very great astonishment, Dobby the house elf peering up at him from beneath his usual 8 woolly hats.
"Hi, Dobby," he said. "What's wrong?"
The elf's eyes were wide with terror, and he was shaking. The members of the DA closest to Harry had fallen silent. Everybody in the room was watching Dobby. The few Patronuses people had managed to conjure faded away into silver mist, leaving the room looking much darker than before.
"Harry Potter, sir,"
squeaked the elf, trembling from head to foot.
"Harry Potter, sir, Dobby has come to warn you, but the house elves have been warned not to tell."
He ran head first at the wall. Harry, who had some experience of Dobby's habits of self-punishment, made to seize him, but Dobby merely bounced off the stone, cushioned by his 8 hats. Hermione and a few of the other girls let out squeaks of fear and sympathy.
"What's happened, Dobby?"
Harry asked, grabbing the elf's tiny arm and holding him away from anything with which he might seek to hurt himself.
"Harry Potter, she—"
Dobby hit himself hard on the nose with his free fist. Harry seized that, too.
"Who's she, Dobby?"
But he thought he knew. Surely only one she could induce such fear in Dobby. The elf looked up at him, slightly cross-eyed and mouthed wordlessly.
"Umbridge?" asked Harry, horrified.
Dobby nodded, then tried to bang his head on Harry's knees. Harry held him at arm's length.
"What about her? Dobby, she hasn't found out about this, about us, about the D.A.?"
He read the answer in the elf's stricken face. His hands held fast by Harry, the elf tried to kick himself and fell to the floor.
"Is she coming?" Harry asked quietly.
Dobby let out a howl and began beating his bare feet hard on the floor.
"Yes, Harry Potter, yes!"
Harry straightened up and looked around at the motionless, terrified people gazing at the thrashing elf.
"What are you waiting for?"
Harry bellowed.
"Run!"
They all pelted towards the exit at once, forming a scrum at the door. Then people burst through. Harry could hear them sprinting along the corridors and hoped they had the sense not to try and make it all the way to their dormitories. It was only 9:10. If they just took refuge in the library or the owlery, which were both nearer.
"Harry, come on!"
shrieked Hermione from the centre of the knot of people now fighting to get out. He scooped up Dobby, who was still attempting to do himself serious injury, and ran with the elf in his arms to join the back of the queue.
"Dobby, this is an order. Get back down to the kitchen with the other elves, and if she asks whether you warned me, lie and say no," said Harry. "And I forbid you to hurt yourself," he added, dropping the elf as he made it over the threshold at last and slammed the door behind him.
"Thank you, Harry Potter!"
squeaked Dobby, and he streaked off. Harry glanced left and right. The others were all moving so fast he caught any glimpses of flying heels at either end of the corridor before they vanished. He started to run right. There was a boy's bathroom up ahead. He could pretend he'd been in there all the time if he could just reach it.
Ah!
Something caught him around the ankles, and he fell spectacularly, skidding along on his front for 6 feet before coming to a halt. Someone behind him was laughing. He rolled over onto his back and saw Malfoy concealed in a niche beneath an ugly dragon-shaped vase.
"Trip Jinx, Potter," he said. "Hey, Professor! Professor! I've got one!"
Umbridge came bustling round the far corner, breathless but wearing a delighted smile.
"It's him!"
she said jubilantly at the sight of Harry on the floor.
"Excellent, Draco, excellent. Oh, very good. 50 points to Slytherin. I'll take him from here. Stand up, Potter."
Harry got to his feet, glaring at the pair of them. He had never seen Umbridge looking so happy. She seized his arm in a vice-like grip and turned, beaming broadly, to Malfoy.
"You hop along and see if you can round up any more of them, Draco," she said. "Tell the others to look in the library. Anybody out of breath. Check the bathrooms. Miss Parkinson can do the girls' ones. Off you go. And you," she added in her softest, most dangerous voice, as Malfoy walked away, "you can come with me to the headmaster's office, Potter."
They were at the stone gargoyle within minutes. Harry wondered how many of the others had been caught. He thought of Ron. Mrs. Weasley would kill him, and of how Hermione would feel if she was expelled before she could take her OWLs. And it had been Seamus's very first meeting, and Neville had been getting so good.
"Fizzing Wisby,"
sang Umbridge. The stone gargoyle jumped aside, the wall behind split open, and they ascended the moving stone staircase. They reached the polished door with the griffin knocker, but Umbridge did not bother to knock. She strode straight inside, still holding tight to Harry. The office was full of people. Dumbledore was sitting behind his desk, his expression serene, the tips of his long fingers together. Professor McGonagall stood rigidly beside him, her face extremely tense. Cornelius Fudge, Minister for Magic, was rocking backwards and forwards on his toes beside the fire, apparently immensely pleased with the situation. Kingsley Shacklebolt, and a tough-looking wizard with very short, wiry hair, whom Harry did not recognise, were positioned either side of the door like guards, and the freckled, bespectacled form of Percy Weasley hovered excitedly beside the wall, a quill and a heavy scroll of parchment in his hands, apparently poised to take notes. The portraits of old headmasters and headmistresses were not shamming sleep tonight. All of them were alert and serious, watching what was happening below them. As Harry entered, a few flitted into neighbouring frames and whispered urgently into their neighbour's ear. Harry pulled himself free of Umbridge's grasp as the door swung shut behind them. Cornelius Fudge was glaring at him with a kind of vicious satisfaction on his face.
"Well," he said, "well, well, well."
Harry replied with the dirtiest look he could muster. His heart drummed madly inside him, but his brain was oddly cool and clear.
"He was heading back to Gryffindor Tower," said Umbridge.
There was an indecent excitement in her voice, the same callous pleasure Harry had heard as she watched Professor Trelawney dissolving with misery in the entrance hall.
"The Malfoy boy cornered him."
"Did he? Did he?"
said Fudge appreciatively. "I must remember to tell Lucius. Well, Potter, I expect you know why you are here."
Harry fully intended to respond with a defiant yes. His mouth had opened, and the word was half formed when he caught sight of Dumbledore's face. Dumbledore was not looking directly at Harry. His eyes were fixed on a point just over his shoulder. But as Harry stared at him, he shook his head a fraction of an inch to each side. Harry changed direction mid-word.
"No." "I beg your pardon," said Fudge.
"No," said Harry firmly.
"You don't know why you are here?"
"No, I don't," said Harry. Fudge looked incredulously from Harry to Professor Umbridge. Harry took advantage of his momentary inattention to steal another quick look at Dumbledore, who gave the carpet the tiniest of nods and the shadow of a wink.
"So you have no idea," said Fudge, in a voice positively sagging with sarcasm, "why Professor Umbridge has brought you to this office. You are not aware that you have broken any school rules?"
"School rules?" said Harry.
"No." "Or ministry decrees," amended Fudge angrily.
"Not that I'm aware of," said Harry blandly. His heart was still hammering very fast. It was almost worth telling these lies to watch Fudge's blood pressure rising, but he could not see how on earth he would get away with them. If somebody had tipped off Umbridge about the DA, then he, the leader, might as well be packing his trunk right now.
"So it's news to you, is it?"
said Fudge, his voice now thick with anger,
"that an illegal student organization has been discovered within this school?"
"Yes, it is," said Harry, hoisting an unconvincing look of innocent surprise onto his face.
"I think, Minister," said Umbridge silkily from beside him, "we might make better progress if I fetch our informant." "Yes, yes, do," said Fudge, nodding, and he glanced maliciously at Dumbledore as Umbridge left the room. "There's nothing like a good witness, is there, Dumbledore?"
"Nothing at all, Cornelius," said Dumbledore gravely, inclining his head. There was a wait of several minutes, in which nobody looked at each other. Then Harry heard the door open behind him. Umbridge moved past him into the room, gripping by the shoulder Cho's curly-haired friend, Marietta, who was hiding her face in her hands.
"Don't be scared, dear. Don't be frightened," said Professor Umbridge softly, patting her on the back. "It's quite all right now. You've done the right thing.
The minister is very pleased with you. He'll be telling your mother what a good girl you've been. Marietta's mother, minister, she added, looking up at Fudge, is Madame Edgecombe from the Department of Magical Transportation, Flu Network Office. She's been helping us police the Hogwarts fires, you know.
Jolly good, jolly good, said Fudge heartily. Like mother, like daughter, eh? Well, come on now, dear, look up. Don't be shy. Let's hear what you've got to... Galloping gargoyles!
As Marietta raised her head, Fudge leapt backwards in shock, nearly landing himself in the fire. He cursed and stamped on the hem of his cloak, which had started to smoke. Marietta gave a wail and pulled the neck of her robes right up to her eyes, but not before everyone had seen that her face was horribly disfigured by a series of close-set purple pustules that had spread across her nose and cheeks to form the word sneak.
"Never mind the spots now, dear," said Umbridge impatiently. "Just take your robes away from your mouth and tell the minister."
But Marietta gave another muffled wail and shook her head frantically.
"Oh, very well, you silly girl, I'll tell him," snapped Umbridge.
She hitched her sickly smile back onto her face and said,
"Well, minister, Miss Edgecombe here came to my office shortly after dinner this evening and told me she had something she wanted to tell me. She said that if I proceeded to a secret room on the 7th floor, sometimes known as the Room of Requirement, I would find out something to my advantage. I questioned her a little further, and she admitted that there was to be some kind of meeting there. Unfortunately, at that point, this hex—" She waved impatiently at Marietta's concealed face, came into operation, and upon catching sight of her face in my mirror, the girl became too distressed to tell me any more.
"Well, now," said Fudge, fixing Marietta with what he evidently imagined was a kind and fatherly look,
"it is very brave of you, my dear, coming to tell Professor Umbridge. You did exactly the right thing. Now, will you tell me what happened at this meeting? What was its purpose? Who was there?"
But Marietta would not speak. She merely shook her head again, her eyes wide and fearful.
"Haven't we got a counter-jinx for this?"
Fudge asked Umbridge impatiently, gesturing at Marietta's face.
"So she can speak freely?"
"I have not yet managed to find one," Umbridge admitted grudgingly, and Harry felt a surge of pride in Hermione's jinxing ability. "But it doesn't matter if she won't speak. I can take up the story from here. You will remember, Minister, that I sent you a report back in October that Potter had met a number of fellow students in the Hogshead in Hogsmeade."
"And what is your evidence for that?"
cut in Professor McGonagall. "I have testimony from Willie Widdershins, Minerva, who happened to be in the bar at the time. He was heavily bandaged, it is true, but his hearing was quite unimpaired," said Umbridge smugly. "He heard every word Potter said, and hastened straight to the school to report to me."
"Oh, so that's why he wasn't prosecuted for setting up all those regurgitating toilets," said Professor McGonagall, raising her eyebrows. "What an interesting insight into our justice system."
"Blatant corruption!"
roared the portrait of the corpulent, red-nosed wizard on the wall behind Dumbledore's desk.
"The Ministry did not cut deals with petty criminals in my day. No, sir, they did not."
"Thank you, Fortescue. That will do," said Dumbledore softly. "The purpose of Potter's meeting with these students," continued Professor Umbridge, "was to persuade them to join an illegal society whose aim was to learn spells and curses the Ministry has decided are inappropriate for school age."
"I think you'll find you're wrong there, Dolores," said Dumbledore quietly, peering at her over the half-moon spectacles perched halfway down his crooked nose.
Harry stared at him. He could not see how Dumbledore was going to talk him out of this one. If Willie Widdershins had indeed heard every word he had said in the Hogshead, there was simply no escaping it.
"Oh, ho-ho!" said Fudge, bouncing up and down on the balls of his feet again. "Yes, do let's hear the latest cock-and-bull story designed to pull Potter out of trouble. Go on, then, Dumbledore, go on. Willie Widdershins was lying, was he? Or was it Potter's identical twin in the Hogshead that day? Or is there the usual simple explanation involving a reversal of time, a dead man coming back to life, and a couple of invisible dementors?"
Percy Weasley let out a hearty laugh. "Oh, very good, Minister, very good."
Harry could have kicked him. Then he saw, to his astonishment, that Dumbledore was smiling gently too. "Cornelius, I do not deny, and nor I am sure does Harry, that he was in the Hogshead that day, nor that he was trying to recruit students to a defence against the Dark Arts group. I'm merely pointing out that Dolores is quite wrong to suggest that such a group was, at that time, illegal. If you remember, the Ministry decree banning all student societies was not put into effect until 2 days after Harry's Hogsmeade meeting, so he was not breaking any rules at all in the Hogshead." Percy looked as though he had been struck in the face by something very heavy. Fudge remained motionless in mid-bounce, his mouth hanging open. Umbridge recovered first.
"That's all very fine, Headmaster," she said, smiling sweetly. "But we are now nearly 6 months on from the introduction of Educational Decree No. 24. If the first meeting was not illegal, all those that have happened since most certainly are."
"Well," said Dumbledore, surveying her with polite interest over the top of his interlocked fingers. "They certainly would be, if they had continued after the decree came into effect. Do you have any evidence that any such meetings continued?"
As Dumbledore spoke, Harry heard a rustle behind him, and rather thought Kingsley whispered something. He could have sworn, too, that he felt something brush against his side, a gentle something like a draught or bird wings. But looking down, he saw nothing there.
"Evidence?" repeated Umbridge, with that horrible, wide, toad-like smile. "Have you not been listening, Dumbledore? Why do you think Miss Edgecombe is here?"
"Oh, can she tell us about 6 months' worth of meetings?" said Dumbledore, raising his eyebrows. "I was under the impression that she was merely reporting a meeting tonight."
"Miss Edgecombe," said Umbridge at once, "tell us how long these meetings have been going on, dear. You can simply nod or shake your head. I'm sure that won't make the spots worse. Have they been happening regularly over the last 6 months?"
Harry felt a horrible plummeting in his stomach. This was it. They had hit a dead end of solid evidence that not even Dumbledore would be able to shift aside.
"Just nod or shake your head, dear," Umbridge said coaxingly to Marietta. "Come on now, that won't reactivate the jinx."
Everyone in the room was gazing at the top of Marietta's face. Only her eyes were visible between the pulled-up robes and her curly fringe. Perhaps it was a trick of the firelight, but her eyes looked oddly blank. And then, to Harry's utter amazement, Marietta shook her head. Umbridge looked quickly at Fudge, then back at Marietta.
"I don't think you understood the question, did you, dear? I'm asking whether you've been going to these meetings for the past 6 months. You have, haven't you?"
Again Marietta shook her head.
"What do you mean by shaking your head, dear?" said Umbridge in a testy voice.
"I would have thought her meaning was quite clear," said Professor McGonagall harshly. "There have been no secret meetings for the past 6 months. Is that correct, Miss Edgecombe?"
Marietta nodded.
"But there was a meeting tonight," said Umbridge furiously. "There was a meeting, Miss Edgecombe, you told me about it, in the Room of Requirement. And Potter was the leader, was he not? Potter organized it. Potter—" "Why are you shaking your head, girl?"
"Well, usually when a person shakes their head," said McGonagall coldly, "they mean no. So, unless Miss Edgecombe is using a form of sign language as yet unknown to humans—"
Professor Umbridge seized Marietta, pulled her round to face her, and began shaking her very hard. A split second later, Dumbledore was on his feet, his wand raised. Kingsley started forwards, and Umbridge leapt back from Marietta, waving her hands in the air as though they had been burned.
"I cannot allow you to manhandle my students, Dolores," said Dumbledore, and for the first time he looked angry.
"You want to calm yourself, Madam Umbridge," said Kingsley in his deep, slow voice. "You don't want to get yourself into trouble now."
"No,"
said Umbridge breathlessly, glancing up at the towering figure of Kingsley.
"I mean, yes, you're right, Shacklebolt. I forgot myself."
Marietta was standing exactly where Umbridge had released her. She seemed neither perturbed by Umbridge's sudden attack nor relieved by her release. She was still clutching her robe up to her oddly blank eyes and staring straight ahead of her. A sudden suspicion, connected to Kingsley's whisper and the thing he had felt shoot past him, sprang into Harry's mind.
"Dolores," said Fudge, with the air of trying to settle something once and for all, "the meeting tonight, the one we definitely know happened."
"Yes," said Umbridge, pulling herself together. "Yes, well, Miss Edgecombe tipped me off, and I proceeded at once to the seventh floor, accompanied by certain trustworthy students, so as to catch those in the meeting red-handed. It appears that they were forewarned of my arrival, however, because when we reached the seventh floor, they were running in every direction. It does not matter, however. I have all their names here. Miss Parkinson ran into the room of requirement for me to see if they had left anything behind. We needed evidence, and the room provided."
And to Harry's horror, she withdrew from her pocket the list of names that had been pinned upon the room of requirement's wall, and handed it to Fudge.
"The moment I saw Potter's name on the list, I knew what we were dealing with," she said softly.
"Excellent," said Fudge, a smile spreading across his face. "Excellent, Dolores, and, by thunder!"
He looked up at Dumbledore, who was still standing beside Marietta, his wand held loosely in his hand.
"See what they've named themselves?" said Fudge quietly. "Dumbledore's Army."
Dumbledore reached out and took the piece of parchment from Fudge. He gazed at the heading scribbled by Hermione months before, and for a moment seemed unable to speak. Then he looked up, smiling.
"Well, the game is up," he said simply. "Would you like a written confession from me, Cornelius, or will a statement before these witnesses suffice?"
Harry saw McGonagall and Kingsley look at each other. There was fear in both faces. He did not understand what was going on, and nor, apparently, did Fudge.
"Statement?" said Fudge slowly. "What? I don't—"
"Dumbledore's Army, Cornelius," said Dumbledore, still smiling as he waved the list of names before Fudge's face. "Not Potter's Army. Dumbledore's Army."
But—
Understanding blazed suddenly in Fudge's face. He took a horrified step backwards, yelped, and jumped out of the fire again.
"You!"
he whispered, stamping again on his smouldering cloak.
"That's right," said Dumbledore pleasantly.
"You organized this?"
"I did," said Dumbledore.
"You recruited these students for your army?"
"Tonight was supposed to be the first meeting," said Dumbledore, nodding. "Merely to see whether they would be interested in joining me. I see now that it was a mistake to invite Miss Edgecombe, of course."
Marietta nodded. Fudge looked from her to Dumbledore, his chest swelling.
"Then you have been plotting against me," he yelled.
"That's right," said Dumbledore cheerfully.
"No!"
shouted Harry. Kingsley flashed a look of warning at him. McGonagall widened her eyes threateningly. But it had suddenly dawned on Harry what Dumbledore was about to do, and he could not let it happen.
"No, Professor Dumbledore!"
"Be quiet, Harry, or I'm afraid you will have to leave my office," said Dumbledore calmly.
"Yes, shut up, Potter,"
barked Fudge, who was still ogling Dumbledore with a kind of horrified delight.
"Well, well, well.
I came here tonight expecting to expel Potter, and instead...
"'Instead you get to arrest me,' said Dumbledore, smiling. "'It's like losing a knut and finding a galleon, isn't it?'
"'Weasley!' cried Fudge, now positively quivering with delight. "'Weasley, have you written it all down? Everything he said? His confession? Have you got it?'
"'Yes, sir. I think so, sir,' said Percy eagerly, whose nose was splattered with ink from the speed of his note-taking.
The bit about how he's been trying to build up an army against the ministry, how he's been working to destabilize me.
Yes, sir, I've got it, yes, said Percy, scanning his notes joyfully.
Very well, then, said Fudge, now radiant with glee. Duplicate your notes, Weasley, and send a copy to the Daily Prophet at once. If we send a fast owl, we should make the morning edition.
Percy dashed from the room, slamming the door behind him, and Fudge turned back to Dumbledore.
"'You will now be escorted back to the Ministry, where you will be formally charged, then sent to Azkaban to await trial.'
"'Ah,' said Dumbledore gently. "'Yes, yes, I thought we might hit that little snag.'
"'Snag?' said Fudge, his voice still vibrating with joy. "'I see no snag, Dumbledore.'
"'Well... said Dumbledore apologetically. I'm afraid I do.
Oh, really?
Well, it's just that you seem to be labouring under the delusion that I'm going to, what is the phrase, come quietly. I'm afraid I'm not going to come quietly at all, Cornelius. I have absolutely no intention of being sent to Azkaban. I could break out, of course, but what a waste of time, and frankly, I can think of a whole host of things I would rather be doing. Umbridge's face was growing steadily redder. She looked as though she was being filled with boiling water. Fudge stared at Dumbledore with a very silly expression on his face, as though he had just been stunned by a sudden blow and could not quite believe it had happened. He made a small choking noise, then looked round at Kingsley and the man with short grey hair, who alone of everyone in the room had remained entirely silent so far. The latter gave Fudge a reassuring nod and moved forwards a little, away from the wall. Harry saw his hand drift, almost casually, towards his pocket. "'Don't be silly, Dawlish,' said Dumbledore kindly. "'I'm sure you are an excellent auror. "'I seem to remember that you achieved outstanding in all your NEWTs. "'But if you attempt to bring me in by force, I will have to hurt you.' "'The man called Dawlish blinked rather foolishly. "'He looked towards Fudge again, but this time seemed to be hoping for a clue as to what to do next.'
"'So,' sneered Fudge, recovering himself, "'you intend to take on Dawlish, Shacklebolt, Dolores, and myself single-handed, do you, Dumbledore?'
"'Merlin's beard, no,' said Dumbledore, smiling. "'Not unless you are foolish enough to force me to.'
"'He will not be single-handed,' said Professor McGonagall loudly, plunging her hand inside her robes.
"'Oh, yes, he will, Minerva.' said Dumbledore sharply. Hogwarts needs you.
Enough of this rubbish, said Fudge, pulling out his own wand. Dawlish, Shacklebolt, take him!
A streak of silver light flashed around the room. There was a bang like a gunshot, and the floor trembled. A hand grabbed the scruff of Harry's neck and forced him down on the floor as a second silver flash went off. Several of the portraits yelled. Forks screeched, and a cloud of dust filled the air. Coughing in the dust, Harry saw a dark figure fall to the ground with a crash in front of him. There was a shriek and a thud, and somebody cried, "No!" Then there was the sound of breaking glass, frantically scuffling footsteps, a groan, and silence. Harry struggled around to see who was half strangling him, and saw Professor McGonagall crouched beside him. She had forced both him and Marietta out of harm's way. Dust was still floating gently down through the air onto them. Panting slightly, Harry saw a very tall figure moving towards them. "'Are you all right?' Dumbledore asked.
"'Yes,' said Professor McGonagall, getting up and dragging Harry and Marietta with her.